Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which is a channel that operates online through the New Books Network. I am your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Ahmad Ash-Shamsi's Rediscovering the Islamic Classics is an astonishing scholarly feat that presents a detailed, sophisticated and thoroughly enjoyable intellectual and social history of the modern publishing industry on what we today consider canonical books of Islamic thought. Painstakingly researched would be a description too mild for the depth and breadth of sources and analysis that Ash-Shamsi mobilizes in this book. Over the course of its 8 delightfully written chapters, readers meet some known and many less known book collectors, editors, Muslim reformers, early Salafis, and European Orientalists whose thought, outlook, normative agendas, and wide-ranging efforts produced a distinct corpus of classical Islamic texts. The canonization of what counted as classical was itself a markedly modern move and gesture, Ash-Shamsi argues. Populated with fascinating narratives of manuscript hunting, editorial discoveries and frustrations, and collaborations between Arab scholars and European Orientalists, Rediscovering the Islamic Classics combines the literary flair of a sumptuous novel with the textual density of a philological masterpiece. This carefully crafted and argued book represents both a profound tribute to a mesmerizingly layered archive of tradition and its actors, and a tremendous service to the field of Islamic studies in particular and religious studies more broadly. It will also make a great text to teach in courses on intellectual history, manuscript studies, modern Islam, Muslim reform, and Islamic law. Here now is my conversation with Professor Ahmad Ash-Shamsi. Hello, Ahmad. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you doing, Sher Ali?
Good, Ahmad. Thank you so much for coming again on the New Books Network. As we were just talking before we started recording this, that your last book, I think we had you maybe 6 years ago, and that was my second New Books interview, and this is maybe my 65th. So congratulations again on publishing another landmark publication. I'm really excited to chat to you about Rediscovering the Islamic Classics, just an incredible book that I just was really mesmerized by the depth of its research and the kinds of analysis that you conducted. So, as you know, our first question on the New Books Network is biographical. Perhaps what you could tell our listeners a bit, how did you get to write this particular book after your first one? What led you to this particular book? And perhaps as part of that question, if you could just perhaps signal to our readers what its key theme is or its key sort of point is. If you could tell our listeners about that also, that'll be great.
I mean, with hindsight, there are always, how can one identify what exactly the roots are of one's interests? You know, I, with hindsight, I could even tell you about, you know, whatever my childhood and how I was interested about, you know, my family library and how that came about. Yeah. But I think in a more direct way, when I started doing manuscript research for my dissertation, I remember standing in front of the card catalog of the Süleymaniye Library in Istanbul and leafing through these cards and looking for these old books, these classical books from the early 2, 3, 4 centuries of Islam, and just being stunned at how few there were, in the sense of, you know, there are tens of thousands of manuscripts, and, you know, most of them are from, you know, the 17th century, the 18th century, maybe the 16th century, but there are so few early texts, so few classical texts. So on the one hand, the manuscripts of classical works are rare, but if you walk into an Arabic bookstore, they are so ubiquitous. And if you look on a syllabus, they're so ubiquitous. If you look at secondary scholarship, they're omnipresent. So what exactly happened? Why is it that we have, of all these, the supposedly great works of Islamic thought, you know, maybe there's one copy left, maybe there's only a fragment left, maybe there's 5 copies left. But then there are books that I had never heard of which we have 150 copies or 200 copies. So what exactly, I mean, first of all, what moment do these manuscript libraries represent? Like, at what point did we have that stage where we had 300 copies of this book that now to me seems really obscure, but we only had one copy of a book that now I find really important? Does that mean that these classics weren't always classics, or weren't always the books that one had to read? And so this idea of tradition, you know, what is the literary tradition, the book tradition? How did it change over time? These were questions that I grappled with. I grappled with also when in graduate school, also studying European history. Of course, there is a lot of scholarship on the Renaissance, the rise of print, and the kind of processes that happened then. And to think, you know, to what extent is this different? To what extent is this, are these similar processes that we see? So this was a question that worked in the background of my mind, and the kind of niggling feeling, you know, as you know, my first book was on the 9th century, was that, you know, am I looking at the 9th century through the manuscript, or, you know, through the library that we have, or am I looking through some other period in which kind of the archive was constituted that I'm looking at, right? The sources, the literary sources. And so the eventual book that came out of it, and, you know, was a process, first of all, of trying to find a way of answering this question, because it's an unwieldy question to start with. And kind of finding ways in which to cut this cake and kind of investigate it, and then also to tell the story. So overall, this is a book on the 19th century when print emerged in the Arab world. It's focused on the Arab world. It's focused on the Sunni Arab world. I think there are reasons for it. I can defend if you're interested in it. But the overall two arguments that I make is that things changed with the coming of print, and they changed dramatically, and they changed for a reason. So the works that we now consider to be classics had either been forgotten, or they were known but not physically available at the dawn of print, and so. You had to have a process of rediscovery, of reconstruction, of finding these works, finding them in different places, editing them, publishing them. And that this is not, in a sense, a natural process, but there were specific actors with specific agendas that achieved this. And so that we have to look at these, you know, when you write a bibliography in and you have this, you know, after the title and the volume numbers, you have editor, and that the editors who were responsible for publishing these works, that they are actors who exerted a very powerful influence on creating this corpus of classics for us. And so it is relevant. These are not just some sort of service providers, but they were actually actors in the formation of what it means to have a corpus of classics, of Arabo-Islamic classics, as they emerged at this time period. In that sense, the overall process that I see is that the kind of literary horizon shifts with the coming of print, that it had been on the later Islamic period from the 16th century onwards, what I call, for just for the sense of brevity, the post-classical period, and that it shifted to the classical period. So we have a classicization, and that this is counterintuitively a process of modernization for the actors involved. So the embrace of the classical instead of the post-classical is pursued in order to facilitate modernization of Arabic and Islamic societies.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. So what we'll do, Ahmed, we'll try to go through, time permitting, the key features of each of the chapters. You begin the book by talking about what you call the book drain to Europe, and also actually to some extent to Istanbul with the Ottoman Empire and different parts of the Arab Middle East. Could you tell a bit to our listeners what were the, who were the actors who were responsible for this book drain? Why did it happen? And what were the implications of this book drain in terms of the libraries and in terms of the book collections in different parts of the Arab Middle East?
All right. First of all, I start with the observation that I think anybody who's familiar with classical Arabic Islamic history is familiar with that the Arabic Islamic literary tradition is extremely rich. Historically, and if you compare it with, let's say, with Europe in the Middle Ages, was far more numerous in terms of the size of libraries, the amount of books that were produced. Of course, paper was adopted much earlier, etc. But that all evidence suggests that the three centuries before the introduction of print, we have a radical reduction of numbers of books, particularly classical works, in these libraries. To give you an example, there's a famous library in Cairo, the Mahmoudiya Library, that in the 15th and early 16th century still had 4,000 books, very rare books, very high quality books. But by the time the Egyptian National Library was founded in 1870, only 58 books were still left in that library. And so the question is, first of all, that's obviously, I have to say, shocking and dramatic decline. But also, where did they go? And there are various ways of explaining this. The first one is a kind of institutional one. The Arab world became used to be a center, a political center, but it became a province of the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century. And so you have a natural kind of movement you have an establishment of very well-endowed institutions of learning and libraries in the Ottoman center, particularly in Istanbul. And you had a movement of works into Istanbul from the Arab world, first in the process of the conquest itself, but then also just in terms of people buying things, people selling their works in the Arab world. At the same time, you have a depletion of these institutions of learning in the Arab world. So when Ali Mubarak writes the kind of history of Cairo in the 19th century, he looks at al-Maqrizi's Khitat from the Mamluk period, and he says, well, in Maqrizi's time, there were still 70 madrasas in Cairo. Active, and by now there's only Al-Azhar. All the other madrasas have ceased their teaching and now are simply just places where people pray. So basically became mosques because the endowments have collapsed. So there is a institutional decline of places where books were kept. That led, obviously, I mean, if you imagine you have a university where the university ceases to teach, what will happen to the university library? I mean, you can't expect that then to be maintained for centuries. So there was a weakness of institutions that also has economic reasons. But then, particularly starting in the 19th century, you have the impact of European book buying mania almost. So you have European libraries that, particularly post Napoleonic conquest of Egypt, get incredibly interested in Arabic manuscripts, and they spend enormous sums on buying Arabic manuscripts. I give the example: the Bavarian Royal Library even sells its Gutenberg Bible in order to buy Arabic manuscripts. So this was like the hot ticket that anybody wanted to get their hands on. You know, ex-Oriental looks. You know, like the light from the east, the wisdom from the east that people wanted to get their hands on, and they had an enormous financial abilities and. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of manuscripts left the Arab world. And, you know, in a manuscript tradition, that has big influence when you still have to produce books by hand. In addition to that, these European collectors were very often interested in early works, in classical works. So in terms of classical works, this really was important, and a lot of works disappeared from the Middle East to Europe. There are many examples. I mean, if you're interested in Ibn Hazm's Tawq al-Hamama, there's only one surviving copy, and it's in Leiden in the Netherlands. So these are processes that really altered the availability of particularly classical texts in the Middle East.
In the next chapter, you talk about multiple things. So what we'll do is we'll divide it up into two different questions, actually. You talk about two tendencies that we find in the 19th century, what you call scholasticism and esotericism. And you talk about how these two tendencies really had a profound impact on the intellectual and social history of book production and circulation and so on. So first of all, if you could just describe for our listeners what you mean by these two categories in this particular context, and then what was the impact of these intellectual currents on book production? Perhaps you could give an example or two also to make things more specific.
Yeah, so, you know, in the answer to my last question, to your last question, I highlighted kind of material reasons for the way book culture had developed by the 19th century in the Arab world. But my discussion on scholasticism and esotericism moves a little bit towards kind of intellectual causes for the way it was in the 19th century. And so when I talk about scholasticism, I mean a particular mode of scholarship, of arguing and of relating to texts. And I borrow this term from European intellectual history, but I think it fits rather well for this particular period. So scholasticism operates on the assumption that there is a more or less fixed body of knowledge that is basically known, and that the work of scholarship is, in the scholastic view, is rigorous conceptual analysis and the careful drawing of distinctions within this body of knowledge. And so there's a process of pruning, of clarifying, and the two primary tools for doing this is rhetorical analysis and logic. And so they become extremely important auxiliary sciences that scholars learn. And the way that scholasticism expresses itself, that's both the case in Europe and the Islamic world, is in the form of commentaries. So there is a relatively limited basis of basic texts on which then a very rich commentary tradition grows. And so part of the result of this is that what is not part of this commentary tradition, what are, you know, the works on which no commentaries have been written, they fall out of the tradition. They're not treated anymore. They're not part of the discussion. And so these scholastic discussions, they do preserve the opinions of classical scholars, but you only find them quoted second hand or third hand or even fourth hand, and you don't see a direct textual engagement anymore of these scholastic scholars with classical texts. And you know, one can really show this that these post-classical scholars didn't actually read these classical scholars. They had a limited amount of opinions that they knew these classical scholars had, but within the scholastic discussion, people paid very little attention to actually reading these classical works directly. On the side of esotericism, there is the classical Sunni epistemology, according to which there are basically two sources of knowledge. There's reason, and then there's revelation. And revelation is the information that was imparted to Muhammad and that ended with the death of Muhammad. Right? So we can access it through scripture, we can access it through traditions attributed to Muhammad, but that is it. What I call esotericism, this esoteric movement does is it adds another source of knowledge, another class of knowledge, and that is related to the idea of inspiration, so that there's a continuation of inspiration that happens, and the theorization of this idea comes into a specific kind of Sufism, Akbarian Sufism, which really draws from kind of Neoplatonic philosophy, the idea that you have the active intellect inspires the sage. And so what this new epistemology does is it really upsets the previous kind of classical epistemology. You have this promise that inspiration is actually the primary source of knowledge. It is a source of certainty. If you look at the scholastic method, it produces all kind of debates and uncertainty. But what inspiration can do is it can give you absolute certainty. And in that way of thinking, book knowledge starts to represent kind of secondhand knowledge. It's a kind of tainted knowledge. It's always subject to doubt, while the kind of highest intellectual state and position you can reach is through inspiration. And so it questions the kind of classical ideal of what it means to be educated, of the value of books. And so, you know, one very famous example, kind of one of the big, possibly the biggest and most well-read, most read scholar of the post-classical period is Abdul Wahhab al-Sha'rani. And so he's an academic superstar of his age. But he gets, disillusioned with the academic world in which he lives, and he goes to a Sufi sheikh who's illiterate, subjugates himself to this illiterate man. And this illiterate man, the first thing he says is, you know, get rid of your library, and then basically we have to kind of deprogram your book knowledge, because that is tainted knowledge. That's bad. You have to reach the level of inspiration. And so what al-Sha'rani does in his later works, ironically, he writes a lot of books afterwards, is he really is instrumental in introducing the idea of inspiration into all kinds of fields of knowledge, whether it's law, whether it's theology, whether it's hadith studies, all these kind of issues which one wouldn't have expected to really upset the epistemological hierarchy that existed in classical Islam. And so these two elements of esotericism and scholasticism, they sideline classical learning and they kind of devaluate it in a certain extent. And so in that sense, it contributes to the already mentioned institutional and material challenges to the maintenance of these classical works.
And then you also talk in the latter half of the chapter that these two trends also, especially esotericism, gets a certain kind of pushback and a certain kind of retrieval of a certain sort of a post-classical notion of scholarship that is very much based on revelation and sort of more traditional sources of authority. And you especially talk about in this vein two major scholars. You talk about many scholars, but two major ones, Murtada Az-Zabidi and Muhammad Shawkani. So could you talk a bit about this pushback that these two scholars presented and what we find in their outlook and their thought?
So I don't want to kind of make a blanket statement about the post-classical period. And so I use these examples of, for example, Zabidi and Shawkani to show that there is an internal critique that is continuously leveled at these. I mean, both the scholastic dimension and the esoteric dimension of scholarship at this period, by scholars who, and in their scholarship, you see the effects of these intellectual currents and who continuously try to search out these classical works and who see the problems in doing this. So both of these scholars are, if you look at their works, are incredibly informed, are incredibly rich scholarly productions. Particularly Shawkani is explicit in this. He criticizes both the narrowness of a lot of intellectual horizons at his time, but also the authority of the inspired teachers, right? So if you have this idea, this notion of esoteric knowledge, this creates a problem of authority, because if you are inspired, if your knowledge is inspired, how can you possibly challenge that knowledge, right? If your knowledge is based on reason, if it's not based on your interpretation of scripture, there is a way of your opponent challenging your position. But if you are simply inspired, there's just no basis on which you can challenge that opinion, and so you have a loosening of the rigorousness of scholarly production. On the other hand, you have with that esoteric move, you have all kind of things that he's upset about. I mean, he tells stories of people going to Baghdad and to visit the grave of Abu Hanifa and claiming that they have studied with Abu Hanifa, right? So with the dead, with the spirit of Abu Hanifa that still exists around his grave, and so these kind of notions of shrine cult that is very important in the post-classical period creates a disharmony with the classical period, because nobody in the classical period claim to study with dead Abu Hanifa, but it becomes something that becomes acceptable in the post-classical period. These are issues that actually infiltrate scholarly discussions. Another point that Shawkani makes is that it's important to read texts directly. And so if you are interested in knowing what the Mu'tazila said, then you have to read the Mu'tazila themselves. You can't just read somebody who you find more doctrinally acceptable summarizing Mu'tazili opinions, but you have to go back to the sources. So you can see this maintenance of high scholarly standards in this rejection of the kind of scholastic mode of knowledge, where you simply participate in a continuous kind of commentary tradition, and that's where you get the information from, but that you keep stepping out of these commentary traditions and you go back to the original sources. The same way Murtada Az-Zabidi some of his works are really encyclopedic in the sense that he gives you like the 150 works that he draws on at the beginning of his work, and he even tells you where he found them, etc. And then he gives you the variants of the manuscript that he consulted. So it's extremely rich, but it really stands out in the sense of you see that this is really a minority attitude that he takes, and in which he really distinguishes himself from his contemporaries and their writings.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The next two chapters really talk about the effects of the active use of print by 19th century, primarily in Egypt, but elsewhere also. And maybe I'll sort of fold these two chapters together in one question. I think perhaps the best way to ask you about these two chapters would be to have you talk about two figures that really I found particularly fascinating, Ahmad Taimur and Ahmad al-Husseini. And one of the strengths of this book, and which makes it a really enjoyable read also, is that you really get a very good sense of the personalities of these actors, what they were after, their strivings, their frustrations, and so on. I think you did a phenomenal job of really capturing their emotions almost in very lyrical prose. That makes it a very formidable book, but also a very enjoyable read. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about these two actors, Ahmad Taimur and Ahmad al-Husseini, and how do their struggles, their strivings connect to the key theme of these two chapters, which is the challenges involved in publishing classical works with the onset of print in the 19th century.
Yeah, so the challenge that existed at this period is, first of all, to find out basic information such as, so what books are there in the tradition? You know, what do you consult? What are the reference works that you look at to find out what books have been written? Where does one find those books, right? What libraries are there? What are there? There are no proper catalogs of these libraries. You might have to travel. There might only be fragments that have survived of specific works. How do you reconstruct a complete text? What if you have different versions of the same book? How do you bring them together? How do you present a fragmentary or a variant textual tradition in print, right? So on the page, if you have variants between the manuscripts, do you just decide what is the right reading and then just take one of them? Do you just choose one of them? Or do you use your own judgment, or do you put footnotes or marginal notes that report the variants? These are all decisions. These are all decisions that weren't laid out yet when print started. And so basically, how do you start a print tradition if you don't have a proper library? So the interesting thing in Egypt, where really indigenous Arabic print starts, is that print starts in 1820, but the National Library is only founded in 1870. So you have half a century of these printers struggling to even know, you need a library to edit and print stuff, right? Well, how do you get even this library together? So it's a kind of chicken and egg problem of how do you start this process? And somebody like Ahmad Taimur, who is, he's representative of a specific class of people in Egypt who are very instrumental in bringing the classics into print. He is not from the scholarly world, from the ulama world. He is, in fact, an offspring of a kind of high-level bureaucratic class in Egypt, of the newly developing state, modernizing state under Muhammad Ali, who kind of adopts Arabic as his primary language of culture. And this is something to remember, is that His family originally were not Arabic speaking. They were Kurds. His older sister, Aisha Taimur, who was a famous poetess, she still wrote in Ottoman Turkish and Persian and Arabic. While Ahmed Taimur really, for him, Arabic was the language of culture. And so you had these high-level bureaucrats who want to create a high-level culture in Arabic. And they push for these classical works. They push for poetry. They push for literature, many of which are not available at the time yet. So they have these weekly salons in which they present manuscripts that they have discovered. They have in their own houses, they have manuscript workshops where they copy books. And then they use their financial means also to have books published, to have books printed. They have, I mean, Ahmed Taimur builds up one of the largest private libraries in Egypt at the time. And after his death, it gets donated to the Egyptian National Library. So you have a man who is kind of representing a new set of people who love books, who are not necessarily in the traditional kind of scholastic mold of scholarship, but who is literate and who, you know, he's also reading French. He can also read French, right? But he isn't just interested in reading Voltaire. He wants to read classical works, and he is a major engine of rediscovering things and helping scholarship. He's somebody who's also, he already starts to get in contact with Orientalist scholars, but he is really a sign of Arabic becoming the language of high culture in Egypt. I mean, this is something that is kind of in a sense counterintuitive, but some of the first, I mean, like in the first generation of print in Egypt, most works on literature are printed in Ottoman or in Persian, not in Arabic. So, you know, the elite, the non-religious scholarly elite in Egypt are not Arabic speaking in the early 19th century, at least. By the end of the 19th century, they have adopted Arabic as the language primarily. But that's something, you know, that one has to keep in mind. And then Ahmed al-Husseini, who is a Azhari-trained scholar who becomes a lawyer. So he's kind of at the cusp, you know, after the British invasion of Egypt in 1882, he becomes a lawyer in the newly established courts. And he is somebody who is interested in discovering early legal texts, and that's how I got to know him. Somebody who gets incredibly upset about the post-classical, what he thinks are distortions of Islamic law. So he is interested in opening up the spectrum of available legal opinions, rather than in the kind of the latest layer of the latest commentaries. And he thinks they are much the earlier legal discussions are much more sophisticated than the later ones. So he considers this to be a way of reforming Islamic law by rediscovering classical works rather than post-classical works. So there is different people with different kind of individual backgrounds and agendas, but for all of them, you know, the rediscovering classical works is a kind of revolutionary act, or is a kind of a radical act in their time, and it's kind of a critique of tradition as it exists at the time in which they live.
The next chapter talks about the emergence of this new category of an actor, the editor or the muhakkik. And here you focus on one particular figure, and I think perhaps through that figure you can talk about the larger theme of this chapter, and that figure is Ahmed Zaki. So could you talk a bit about who he was and what sorts of really multiple activities in terms of manuscript collection and editing that he launched and executed? And really through him, we get this new category of the editor. So tell us a bit about him and his career, and then this new role of the editor that emerges.
Yeah, first of all, I want to apologize. This is not, you know, the fact that I talk about so many Ahmeds is not intended. It's not some sort of narcissistic strain. So Ahmed Zaki, like Taimur, came from, well, actually, Ahmed Taimur was just the son of a high-level bureaucrat. He himself was not a high-level bureaucrat, but Ahmed Zaki himself became a high-level member of the Egyptian government. But at the same time, he was incredibly interested in the past, not just the Arabic Islamic past. He was also interested in the Pharaonic past. He was also very closely in contact with Orientalist scholars. He was sent by the Egyptian government as a representative of the government to Orientalist world congresses that were held in Europe at the time. So he became somebody who became familiar with Orientalist techniques of editing, Orientalist philology. What is important to remember is that the early presses, the early Arab presses, the person who was in charge of getting the manuscript into print was called a musahih, a corrector. These were people who were employed by the press to do that job. So they were educated people very often. They were Azhari educated, but they got the job, you know, there's this manuscript, get it into print. Now, what Ahmed Zaki did was, he obviously, you know, he was financially independent. His job was not to work at the press as a proofreader, basically, as a corrector. But he had intellectual interests in these works. And so he termed this, he coined this term, muhakkik, and he used it as a translation of the Arabic, of the European or kind of Western term of editor. So somebody who collects manuscripts, who does the philology, the textual criticism. He adopts the way of Orientalist publishing of Arabic works. So classically speaking, the manuscript tradition and the early print, if you have, if you add text to the main text, you put it on the margins normally, right? So it's marginal writing. Orientalist scholarship, they normally put it in footnotes or at the bottom of the text. So he does that. He adopts the idea of a critical apparatus. So, for example, the variants. If you have variants in different, if you have whatever five different manuscripts and they spell different, I mean, they have different words in specific places, then you note that in this critical apparatus at the bottom of the page. He adopts that. So he adopts a specific kind of ways in which to bring books into print. In the classical tradition, basically the corrector writes stuff at the end of the book, like the copyist, right? So there's a continuation from the scribal tradition into the corrector tradition. But then the editor, instead, he writes an introduction, right? So his voice is the first voice you hear. His name is, you can see on the top, on the front page. He is in charge. He tells you where he finds the manuscript, and he maybe gives you a biography of the writer, etc. So he gets involved in that. He also gets involved in actual discovery of books. So he travels around. He travels to Europe. He travels to Istanbul to discover works and to either have them copied or to even photograph them. So he photographs thousands of manuscripts. These photographs are still in the Egyptian National Library today. So this is a way of, you know, we talked about the book drain to Europe. This is a way of getting these books back in copied versions to the Middle East, where they can be published. And he also uses the machine of the government to fund these expeditions. So he discovers a book by Ibn al-Muqaffa, the 8th century great scribe and literary author. He discovers that in Istanbul, and he brings it back to Egypt and makes it, has it printed by the government press and makes it a required reading in Egyptian schools. So the text is only exists in one or two copies before, and then 2 years later, every Egyptian school child has to read it. So he uses the institution of the modernizing state also to spread these works widely, because he believes that they are important.
Now, in the next chapter, you show that the coming of print and the possibilities that it enables also brought into view particular reformers, and you especially focus on two Muslim reformers, one the more well-known Muhammad Abduh, and then Tahir al-Jazairi, and you really focus on aspects of these two actors that perhaps we know much less about. And especially you focus on their sort of literary and ethical projects that they mobilized and presented at this juncture. So could you talk a bit about these two figures? What did they find? What were they dissatisfied with in their intellectual milieu? And how did they go about addressing that through this new possibilities of book production that were opened up by the 19th century?
Yeah, I have to say, I did not originally intend to write anything about Abdul al-Jazairi. I was really not aware of the really importance of these two figures in the story that I want to tell. So in secondary scholarship, primarily these people are discussed as modernists, as reformers. And here the modernism and reformism is about politics, it's about society, it's about science, all these kind of things. But the connection of these two people for classical works is really, really profound. So first of all, I had to learn that they're really crucial in the process of rediscovering classics. Tahir al-Jazairi was the man behind the founding of the Zahiriya Library in Damascus, the most important library in the Arab world after the Dar al-Kutub in Egypt. He was also behind the founding of the Khalidiyya Library in Jerusalem. He was behind the publication of many books. He was a great manuscript collector himself. A lot of early texts that are really crucial to our understanding were collected by Tahir al-Jazairi. So the Kitab al-Asnam that tells us about pre-Islamic Arabia, he discovered that book. The Kitab al-Intisar, the first printed book that we have on Mu'tazili thought, a great source for Mu'tazili thought. That was a book that he discovered. And then you have Muhammad Abdu, who is the man behind the foundation of a unified Azhar library. The modern Azhar library was founded by Abdu. He founded an organization to revive classical Islamic literature, including a Tabari's tafsir, including a Jurjani's work on linguistics, including Sahnoun's Mudawwana. He was the one who published Al-Hamadani's Maqamat, Imam Ali's Nahj al-Balagha. So first of all, just on the very basis, they were very much involved in publishing classical works. But as you mentioned, I make the point that for them this was an ethical project, and they really believed that both the project of creating a powerful modern society was to a large extent an ethical project, and on the one hand, the development just of Arabic prose. Abdu was very much involved in journalism, and for him, journalism was an ethical, communal work of having a rational debate about what is good for society. And in order to facilitate that, you needed to have clear language. I mean, that sounds, you know, one just first has to get used to the idea, right? That this is, if you don't have clear language, if you don't have language that can express and that can argue, then you don't have a state. Right? If you don't have ethical literature, just literature. He was the one, the first one to institute professorships for classical literature at Al Azhar, right? Literature, because he believed that literature helps the ethical formation of individuals who read literature. So for him, discovering classical literature, I mentioned Ibn Khaldun's Muqaddima was very important for him, as it was for many others at his time. To read this prose, to read clear analytic prose in Arabic that can express ideas and that can allow people to interact rationally and with each other was absolutely crucial. So he was also the one who taught even philosophical works of ethics, Sufi works of ethics, right? So these modernists were not anti-Sufi in some sort of absolute sense. Ethical literature, Sufi literature, was very much preferred and admired by people like Abdu and Jazairi and many other people I talk about. So the discovery of the classics is part of a sense of what the you know Nahda, what they called Nahda, the Renaissance of Arab peoples, Muslim peoples, is meant to be about. Adela, is that clear?
Absolutely. And one thing I should mention before we move to the next question, the next chapter is, you know, one of the very interesting thing I found throughout the book was this very interesting stories of collaborations between European Orientalists and these indigenous Arab scholars. And I think perhaps the most poignant moment came in this chapter. So I just wanted to alert our listeners to when you talk about this very interesting collaboration between, and friendship really, between Tahir al-Jazairi and Goldzahir. And you talk about how, you know, when they were in their early 20s, Goldzahir visits Damascus and Al-Jazairi takes him to different bookshops and salons and so on. And then many years later, 30 years later, he writes him a very poignant letter in which he reminisces about their friendship and talks about, you know, their friendship in very warm ways. This comes in on pages 176 and 177 in the book. So I just wanted to alert listeners to this very interesting aspect that keeps on repeatedly coming up in this book, but especially in this chapter. Moving to the next chapter, you also talk about with this theme of reformers and their different intellectual projects, how they were advanced through the printing press. In the next chapter, you talk about a category of scholars whom you call the early Salafi thinkers. And you make a very interesting point about how, when we think about this category today, how much it's different from these early Salafi thinkers. And I was wondering if you could perhaps focus on this one thinker, of course, you talk about Jamal ad-Din al-Qasimi. And through him, perhaps, if you could talk a bit about the projects of these early Salafi thinkers. And you also make a point in this chapter of their attraction to Ibn Taymiyyah and how he was reconfigured and translated in this moment. So if you could perhaps fold that aspect also into your analysis.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was hesitant even using the term Salafi. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the associations that we have with the term today and that the association might stand in the way of actually,
right,
you know, understanding this figure by the way, in the way that he deserves to be understood in his own context, right? But I mean, Qasim is one of the first people to actually refer to themselves as Salafi. So, you know, I can't overlook the fact that he does that, and therefore that. That's why what I also use for him. But I think what is important is not to use the term Salafi as a kind of anachronistic sense, in an anachronistic sense. And so, contrary to what we connect to it today, for him, Salafism was not some sort of narrowness. He was, in fact, somebody who was extremely open to all kind of things, and you know. I think the chapter on him is also a chapter about intellectual networks all over the Muslim world and also into, you know, the non-Muslim, I mean, also with non-Muslims or Orientalists, etc. So this is a man who is very much engaged in the discovery of works and the publication and kind of seeking to publish works. He was a Damascene scholar who had very wide interests. You know, he published texts by Yahya ibn Adi, who was an Arabic, like a kind of Christian Arabic philosopher, by Ibn Arabi, by Ibn Taymiyyah, by Al-Ghazali, by Ibn Tumart. So, I mean, already from that, just from that list, like, okay, so how do you classify somebody who does that? Right? But somebody who clearly, I mean, he was particularly interested in Ibn Taymiyyah, and that's something to keep in mind, that Ibn Taymiyyah's works, basically, they started being published in 1900, and then the availability of these texts exploded afterwards in the next generation or so. So it's really something that was even in the age of print, a relatively late introduction, the work of Ibn Taymiyyah. But what Ibn Taymiyyah stood for these reformers was, first of all, somebody who was a model for methodology, but also for specific substance that they were interested in. In terms of methodology, it's important to keep in mind that Ibn Taymiyyah kind of, in a way, he stands halfway, right, between us or between the, these modernists and the prophetic age, right? So he's somewhere halfway. You know, he dies in the 8th century. So he's somebody who himself has to deal with the past. And he does this in a, I think, you know, awe-inspiring way. I mean, he's uniquely well-read in the tradition, right? And not just in the Sunni tradition. He's interested in all branches of Shiism. He's interested in philosophy, not just the philosophers he wrote in Arabic. He's interested in the Peripatetics and the Pre-Socratics, and he's somebody who's interested in the Bible. He's interested in other religions. He's interested, you know, he's somebody who's extremely well-read, and who cites stuff in an almost kind of modern academic way of citation, and who is somebody who kind of reading him kind of opens up a world, right? It's very different. Like it's probably the polar opposite to this kind of scholastic way of arguing or the kind of experience reading a text by Ibn Taymiyyah. Whether you agree with him or not, it doesn't mean that you have to follow him in everything he says. But the way he lays out the evidence is just incredibly enriching for the kind of the reconstructions, the genealogical thought that he puts into understanding questions. So, in a sense, he is also somebody who's like a guide to the tradition. Right? If you read Ibn Taymiyyah, you don't just read Ibn Taymiyyah; you also read about, you know, you learn about various factions, about various streams and currents within Islamic thought. Methodologically speaking, that is very attractive. In terms of substance, there are specific things that these modernists felt oppressed by, that they found in Ibn Taymiyyah kind of as a related soul who had these issues as well. So part of practices such as grave visitations, the idea that that saints, that dead saints, have powers over the world, right? I mean, this is something that these days seems kind of rather far-fetched, but really was an issue in late 19th century, early 20th century, the idea of the powers of the dead saint, right? If you couldn't have kids, you went to the grave of your local saint and, you know, circumambulated the tawaf around the grave a couple of times, and then you could have children. Or that the saints had power over the weather or the harvest, these kind of issues. If you didn't get kids, you'd say, oh, you know, I dedicate this kid to the saint. And then once the kid was born, you had to bring the kid to the grave and then sacrifice an animal there or something like this. What sometimes one calls like a popular religion that grew up around saint worship, that for these modernists was just totally unacceptable. It was the kind of the worst type of superstitions. And it's the kind of the obstacle on the way to a modern society is these kind of superstitious practices. And Ibn Taymiyyah has, you know, very powerful critiques of exactly these kind of ideas, and not just critiques of them, but he also knows where they come from, right? I mean, he knows that that a lot of, you know, like where you know, kind of under the guise of specific kind of Sufisms, you have ideas that came from other philosophical traditions or other religious traditions. And so if you read him, you actually have some sort of intellectual ammunition that you can use in the various struggles at the time and place that you are. And so what Al-Qasimi did was, he, being in Damascus, having access to the Zahiriyya library, he had his students copy out a lot of texts of Ibn Taymiyyah. And you know, through various networks, among other people like Alusis in Iraq and you know, people all over the over the world, finding other texts and then sending them to Egypt and having them printed, and from where Ibn Taymiyyah then became a kind of a household name, right, for intellectual thought. Even though before that he was very, very much marginalized in the preprint era.
Now, the final chapter of your book, you begin by talking about a really fascinating episode or a controversy concerning the famous Taha Hussein and then a lesser-known student of his, Mahmoud Shakir, who basically disagrees sharply with Taha Hussein on a particular issue. I was wondering if it is okay for you to perhaps recount briefly what this episode was about, and then how does it connect to a broader theme that you focus on in this chapter, which is the whole question of textual criticism or the whole question of determining the authenticity of particular texts and how that becomes a very central motif and problem in this time period.
Yeah, so what is generally known in Arabic intellectual history as the Qadiyat Shi'ar al-Jahili, so the case of pre-Islamic poetry, which pitted Taha Hussein, who was professor at the Egyptian university, today that's Cairo University, kind of an academic superstar of his day, who wrote in, if I remember correctly, 1926, a book in which he argued that pre-Islamic poetry is in fact not authentic, i.e. it does not come from the pre-Islamic period. It was basically created, invented afterwards, in order to kind of, and then back projected into the pre-Islamic period. And Mahmoud Shakir was his, was 17-year-old student at college. He was a son of a great Azhari scholar who was a good friend of Muhammad Abdu. So he came from a very influential family. Many of his, like his brother and his cousin, would become famous editors. He studied with the same teacher of Arabic literature as Taha Hussein had done. And so he took his class, and he was very critical of Taha Hussein's idea and his hypothesis. Taha Hussein argued that that the methodological basis for revisionist idea that pre-Islamic poetry is not authentic is based on Descartes' method, right? And the idea that if you use skeptical methodology, i.e., you don't accept anything except if you have evidence for it, then you come to this conclusion that pre-Islamic poetry is not authentic. And in addition, he makes this methodological point that the Islamic tradition is uncritical, and that you can the only way of reaching a critical viewpoint is adopting Descartes and in general, you know, kind of a Western methodological position from which to see the Islamic tradition. And Mahmoud Shakir found that problematic in various ways. I mean, he found it problematic on the actual basis of the argument of Taha Hussein. And I think history has given, has shown that actually Mahmoud Shakir was most probably right. I think people accept the authenticity of pre-Islamic poetry today. But also that there is something particularly troubling about this view of critical rationality being necessarily Western, and that somehow the tradition itself having no indigenous tools by which to be critical. So this you know, the kind of juxtaposition of the critical Western mind, the critical Western methodology that has to be adopted in order to question this uncritical Oriental mind and intellectual tradition. And in my mind, Mahmoud Shakir actually, you know, eventually, I mean, becomes one really of the great intellectuals, great Arab intellectuals of the 20th century. If I achieve that people actually pay more attention to him people in the Arab world, there's a great fan club of Mahmoud Shakir, but I think in Western literatures, people have not really recognized his contributions. He wrote an incredible, his work is incredibly important, in my opinion. But I think what this chapter stands for is a realization of, you know, once you rediscover the classics, what do you do with them, right? What do you, how do you handle them in a methodologically sophisticated way? Who has the power to speak for those people in the past, right? So this is a time not just of modernization, not just of printing press. This is also the time of overwhelming Western dominance on the level of politics, on the level of, you know, colonialism, of economy, of academia, of intellectual discourse. And you have this, you know, the question of Orientalism, outsiders that are institutionally so powerful, who are so powerful in terms of prestige coming from the West, that the ideal of an intellectual exchange breaks down. So Mahmud Chakir and his brother Ahmed Chakir, what Ahmed Chakir says is like, okay, you have a discussion with an Orientalist, you know, I might have the better arguments, but everybody will follow the Orientalist because, you know, he has a PhD from a Western university, right? So there's a kind of frustration, not with the idea of critical scholarship, but of that in fact there is not a level playing field of discussions, and that you have these outsiders who have, you know, I mean, as Ahmed Chakir already says, you know, who learn Arabic in their late 20s and who might be very good in some areas, but who are given this privilege kind of almost unchecked way talk about the Arabic Islamic heritage and have this accepted just because the kind of power relations that exist at this specific time. And so the discussion of methodology take on this added weight of saying, okay, so how can we critically use these things? And so there's a, you know, I talk about historical criticism and the kind of, you know, how do you date texts? How do you use the information in texts? But then also the real textual criticism of, you know, how, you know, what are the methods by which to establish the most accurate kind of texts? And then, you know, you have what's called Lachmann's method of textual criticism, which is a kind of quasi-scientific way of doing this. Right? And so there's this kind of, oh, there's this method from Europe that can establish certainty with regards to our texts, and we don't have that. So we're kind of relying on these Orientalist editions. But what I want to show is that there is a give and take in methodological developments, and then there is an emergence of kind of an indigenous philology that really engages in a very interesting way. I mean, I don't know whether you got these vibes, but I think there are a lot of I think the best of Edward Said's criticism is already, you know, in 1930s Egypt, people make these arguments, I think, in a very coherent way. The tradition, selectively engaging with Orientalist philology and coming up with their own philological standards and practices that then give us the kind of works that we now consider to be the kind of standard works of editions from the 1940s onwards. Ahmed Chakir edits Shafi's Risala, for example. I got back to my hobby horse here, but to show how even like on the level of philology and methodology, you have really interesting discussions of how to approach the past and how to critically approach the past, because it's not just enough to produce stuff, but also to know what to do with it, to know how to criticize, even authenticity of texts and establish texts accurately.
In the conclusion, Ahmed, you make several points, but one important point that you make is that conceptually, you make a point about how we should think about this post-classical scholarship of the 18th, 19th century, and you make a point that you know, it is certainly problematic to look at this period and the scholarship as marked by some kind of intellectual decay or decline and so on. But you also nuance that a bit by saying that, you know, one should also be careful not to undermine the challenges and the problems that confronted this period and this scholarship. So could you explain that argument for our listeners?
Well, I mean, originally, my original draft of this book had zero discussion on this, you know, on that topic. And everybody who read it said, well, you know, you really have to address the elephant in the room, because anybody who's going to read this will say, oh, is he trying to resurrect the narrative of decline? And what I have to say really to this is, in a sense, like, you know, I'm a very pedestrian thinker. You know, if concepts get too big, I kind of shut down. You know, I can't answer something as big as, you know, was the post-classical period a period of decline? That's just too big a cake to swallow for me. You know, my reflex is just to say, well, it depends what you mean, right? You know, and I think what needs to be said is that, you know, this is a study of the classics of you know, the classical works. I mean, the early Arabic works that were written by primarily by Muslims, also some of them by non-Muslims, and their status and their development in the post-classical period and then in the modern period. And so I can say things about the specific question, and that these works, you know, that the status of these works definitely declined in the post-classical period. And I just, you know, you can say this is a positive thing, or you can say this is a negative thing. You can, you know, if you believe that, you know, I mean, I personally don't think that claims to inspiration are methodologically valid. You know, I mean, if you look at my footnotes, I'm not making any claims of inspiration. I don't think that's, you know, I don't think that's appropriate. And I agree there with the classical scholars, and I agree with the modernist scholars. That's not a way of conducting scholarships or discussions to claim inspiration, because you know it's a non, you know, it kind of ends any kind of debate, and it's just basically a claim to authority. It's not a claim about truth, but you know, one might see this another way. So for me, it is simply about the question of decline, you know, as it's put out there. A question of, oh, is the post-classical period bad? And then does that mean that it justifies colonialism or Western intrusion or these kind of big questions? Well, you know, really, this is not, you know, I did not start this project with any of this in mind. I started with a specific question about the trajectory of the classics and their status before print. And this is my answer. And you know, when I say that, you know, the institutions of bookkeeping, you know, libraries, etc., had declined in the you know, until the 19th century, then yeah, that's, I mean, I think you can actually put numbers on this. Right? There were actually fewer books, and you can look at these inventories of these libraries, and you know, I've written an article about this as well. Well, there is a clear numerical decline in this. Does that mean that we can therefore say that this entire time period is, you know, we can paint it with this brush of decline? No, obviously not. That's not a way you deal with intellectual history or whatever. And I hope we've gotten beyond this. But it's not just a Punch and Judy show. It's not like, you know, what side are you on? You know, what football team do you support? It's like, you know, you have to look at specific questions and answer these specific questions. And then, you know, to make your general view more sophisticated. And, you know, I the last thing I want to do is kind of discourage people from studying the post-classical period. The last thing, you know, I just want to show that there are changes. There is history there. But, you know, that history should not be subject to us establishing some sort of sensitivities about, oh, if you say this, or you shouldn't use that word because, you know, that'll lead to this kind of idea. Well, I think it's important to us just looking at this and discussing it openly and just creating more sophisticated images rather than just falling from one to the other extreme of saying, oh, it's decline. Oh, no, it was, you know, not decline. I mean, it's just, what exactly does this mean? You know, I think we just need to populate that map much more, you know, in a much more sophisticated way. I mean, there's studies about, you know, the discoveries of logic in that period. And I totally, you know, I've read these books, and it seems solid scholarship on this. But, you know, these are different things. You know, I'm not talking about a general judgment on a specific time period, but this is a focused study of a specific topic of book culture, of classical book culture. And I hope, I mean, as a friend recently said, you know, this is going to be a discussion starter on something rather than some sort of like kind of ideological battle over the meaning or defense or attack on a specific time period.
So as we're coming to the end of our time, Ahmad, I was wondering if you could, I mean, after this, such a monumental book, I mean, you of course deserve a few months of break and celebration, but what's the next masterpiece that you are thinking of? What's the next project?
Thank you so much for your kind words. It's I've been taking more than a few months, but I, in terms of what my next large project is, I think I'm not ready yet to utter this publicly. I still have to work on this. But I have to say the thing that I'm just working on right now is an article on the question of religion. You know, you're aware of this, of course. In the last 30 years, there have been these discussions. You know, is religion a Western-centric term that grew out of specific relation, you know, developments in Christianity and has been falsely imposed on non-Western, non-Christian societies? And I'm writing an article on a discussion of Ibn Taymiyyah's that I discovered when writing my book now on the nature of deen. Right? Deen very often is generally translated as religion in English. And my argument is going to be, and I hope I'm not going to eat my words later on, but I think my argument is going to be that we really see a theory of religion in the 14th century there that is very that we can very productively translate as religion, and that has very interesting parallels in our modern conception of religions, but also I think enriches the discussion of what religion is. So that's an article that I'm working on right now. As for bigger projects, I'll take the summer and read widely and then see where I'm going.
Rediscovering the Islamic Classics, How Editors and Print Culture Transformed an Intellectual Tradition by Professor Ahmad al-Shamsi, published by Princeton University Press in 2020. Well, thank you so much, Ahmad, for coming back to the New Books Network and for this incredible book that I'm sure will spark many discussions and conversations. I'm sure our listeners also really appreciated your very lucid and thorough answers. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Sherali.
So this was my conversation with Professor Ahmad al-Shamsi about his phenomenal new book, Rediscovering the Islamic Classics. I hope you enjoyed this episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is a channel that operates online through the New Books Network. I also hope you will join us next time for another fresh episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.